Thanks for listening to this podcast of Trending with Timory. If you haven't already subscribed, please catch us wherever you love to listen to your podcast, from the Relevant Radio app to Apple, YouTube, you name it, we are there. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to go and give us a 5-star review to help other people discover the podcast. Anything you share in terms of episodes, whether it's texting it to a friend, posting on social media, helps to build up the kingdom for God, to help confront the challenging issues we face as a culture, but with joy, with hope, and with an eternal perspective where our faith collides with everyday life, bringing eternal principles to help us live our life joyfully.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our weekly Marriage Hour here on Trending. We're going to unpack with Dr. Nicholas Kaderis, the country's foremost technology addiction expert. He's here joining Trending to discuss porn's impact on relationship and the transgender effect of social media on kids and teenagers. It's the trans effect. We'll also discuss today on Trending a story of hope. I know a lot of parents are trying to navigate and figure out just how do I spend more time with my kids in the face of growing bills and this pressure to be in the office, to work, and yet this need that your children have. I have a story of hope. One woman shares an answer to prayers. It's a reminder that God really does help us through challenging situations, especially when we're trying to do the right thing. We'll also talk about how the defense of abortion for some people goes all the way up to birth and after. I'll give you the latest news coming from California and other pro-abortion advocates who are arguing in favor of partial birth abortion. That's how far this goes for some people. We'll also take your questions on the abortion debate. The number is 1-888-914-9149. You can also ask your question on my Instagram. Just direct message me or comment with your question in my story on social media. Just follow me at Timory, T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. Joining me now is Dr. Nicholas Kaderis. He's a country's foremost technology addiction expert. And we're going to unpack in a little bit the trans effect of social media on kids and teenagers. But now I want to unpack pornography's impact on relationships. Dr. Nicholas Kaderis is an Ivy League educated psychologist. He's taught neuropsychology at the doctoral level. He's the author of an excellent book that everyone should read. It's called Glow Kids: How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trans. He's a current CEO of Omega Recovery that helps treat young people struggling with substance addiction, mental health, and or technology addiction. You can find them at omegarecovery.org. Dr. Kaderis, welcome back to Trending.
Well, thank you for having me on the show again.
In your areas of expertise, you work a lot with people circling around addiction, and you've studied a lot of the neuropsychology and psychology behind pornography addiction. I'd like to hear your thoughts on pornography's impact with everything from the brain to our ability to relate to other people in relationships today.
Yeah, sure. I think it's pretty clear that pornography obviously has grown, and as digital technology has grown, so has pornography. Once upon a time, pornography used to be limited to, the I don't want to be cliche, but, the Playboy magazines and, static media that used to be snuck around periodically. And the ubiquity, how pervasive it's become, pornography has become so all around us in the culture. It's so available, so readily available. It's push button pornography, where essentially any adult or child has access to the internet. So there's as all dopamine activating types of digital experiences can be habit forming, in the same way that gaming addiction could be habit forming, because it raises our dopamine in a way that can be very habituating. And we know that dopamine is the neurotransmitter that makes people become addicted to something. Cocaine has a high dopamine effect, and things like crystal meth have a high dopamine effect. Well, pornography has a high dopamine effect. Now, we know sexual arousal Originally, evolutionarily, it was intended to raise our dopamine response because it was supposed to incentivize procreation. And so procreating was supposed to, which kept our species alive, was supposed to feel pleasurable. And so dopamine was released when people had sexual experiences. Pornography sort of hijacks that species-sustaining procreation effect in ways that don't have any benefit, really, and in a way that becomes really habituating. And we're the leap that's happened now between, let's call it old-school pornography and digital pornography, is that it's really being consumed much more voraciously and by younger and younger and younger people. So I've worked with children who have really been exposed to pretty hardcore imagery at ages 7, 8 years old that really, really aren't things that we never had seen 20 years ago, where if a teenager snuck an issue of a Playboy magazine and maybe he saw something he wasn't supposed to see, or she saw something she wasn't supposed to see. Now we're seeing really hardcore imagery that can become very habit forming. And then it desensitizes people, both adults and children, to real intimacy and sexual experiences that should be part of intimacy. So it really distorts intimate relationships in toxic ways.
When you say it desensitizes young people to relationships, how does that work on the level of the brain? How is this getting in the way of proper brain function to form healthy relationships or to build relationships at all?
So if you speak to pediatricians today, there's a phenomenon now called adolescent erectile dysfunction. And that's on a very basic level, for the first time, you have teenagers that are so desensitized to sexual experiences that they can't, they have erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Right. And that never used to happen before. You know, so now you have teenagers that are going out on their first dates and, you know, going to, you know, good luck going on the school prom if you've been watching hours and hours of really graphic pornography. So it desensitizes what we might call a normalized intimate relationship. And because the brain needs to keep raising the intensity of stimulation to keep that level of arousal, you can quickly get desensitized to certain imagery. Gamers need higher levels of intensity of their gaming. They need to keep leveling up to keep their engagement. Similar to pornography, what was arousing yesterday now needs to be tweaked for tomorrow. And so you have children and adults who need to increase the amplitude or the intensity of the imagery in ways that no human being can keep up with or no real relationship can keep up with. So you have people in relationships who aren't devoting themselves in a healthy way to the relationship because now the pornography has made their partner not as appealing or as attractive. And let's face it, the pornography is... it doesn't take any effort. It doesn't, you know, relationships take effort and work where pornography doesn't. And so it destroys, it makes people lazy in their relationships.
Mm-hmm. It destroys basic human interconnectivity and, you know, relationships and dialogue. Correct. You know, I remember some years ago, I was looking at kind of a comparison and how, you know, the way that many boys function today is the way almost like a cow would, where a cow, a female cow, and he is across the street. And, you know, here you have a bull that sees the female calf and can just go across the street, not look both ways and have at it. But a teenager or a human person is meant to go up to the stoplight, press the button, cross the street, ask a girl for her number, get to know her. And there are all these very human interactions that are supposed to occur. But you mention erectile dysfunction that's occurring for adolescent boys and teenagers, very young boys today. But that also plays into the fact that young girls are experiencing extreme levels of pressure from the young boys because they're asking for things that otherwise never would have been asked for because they need that level of stimulation in order to experience arousal. Can you talk to the psychological impact this is having on young women today and whether or not really young girls' brains are prepared for that level of peer pressure today and what that does to them?
Well, pornography has always objectified women. You know, the women's rights movement have always been well, not always, you know, from back in the days of Gloria Steinem, but, you know, there was the sense that there was an objectification of women. Interestingly, when you talk to teenage boys today who have viewed pretty intensive pornography imagery, it also objectifies the male. And I've worked with young boys who are avoidant of relationships because they feel intimidated by what they've seen, right? Because let's face it, our the people who are in the porn business are not typical in their sexual, I'm trying to be tactful here, in they're outliers, and both in their prowess or with their physical attributes. And so it's in the same way that young female girls develop body image issues and disordered eating when they compare themselves to fashion models. If you shift this over now to pornography ideals or models, you have young women that are now have been objectified and are pressured now to, you know, the art of courtship is no, is a lost art. As you were saying, you know, there's no such thing as courtship anymore. And, you know, that, that intimate interpersonal process that developed over thousands of years and to get to know someone has now been reduced to physical acts. And it really messes with, it's not a psychological term, but it messes with the head of the young male. It also messes with the head of the young female because, you know, there's pressure to perform from both parties to live up to these visual imageries, visual images they've seen in these really toxic and pervasive videos. And it, and you can't unsee these things. Once you know, I've worked with 9-year-olds that have seen things that they can't unsee. So when you prematurely sexualize a child or a young teen, that does some damage because now it's developmentally inappropriate content, and that will distort their sexuality potentially lifelong if they don't, unless they get some help with it.
So you mentioned for girls this pressure and these requests that are being asked of them by the young boys today. You mentioned body image issues, self-esteem issues. How does this play out when repeated requests are occurring and these girls are trying to have normal relationships, but this pressure continues to rise? What types of decisions are girls making as a result of this?
Well, so obviously we're a social species, and social pressure is great, especially at that fragile age. You know, rare is the person that has the strength of character or the strength of the moral fiber to really stand up to against the tide of peer pressure. And so, you know, hopefully kids or teenagers or young people are in healthy settings with like-minded groups. But if you take somebody and you put them in a, you know, what's the old saying? If you run with wolves, you become a wolf. You know, if you're in a certain peer group, you know, we know by social learning theory, people tend to live up or live down to the peer group that they're in. So it's really hard to buck the trend. And I've seen some of the quote unquote best raised kids who were raised by the most wonderful families and raised with faith and with ethics have a hard time. Because even if they don't give in to the pressure, the temptation, it wears them down. It gives them a sort of almost a mental fatigue where, I haven't given them to the pressure, but I'm just, it's just devastating to me to have to keep fighting this fight continuously.
Mm-hmm. And could that lead to depression and anxiety at a certain point? Although they're fighting and they're trying to, it's almost an internal implosion in the face of constant social media and social face-to-face pressure.
Absolutely. Depression without a doubt. Depression without a doubt, because now you just get worn down. Any kind of chronic, you know, it's a sort of almost like a form of chronic fatigue, you know, because you're just getting worn down over and over again. It's like when someone is in a verbally abusive relationship and that wears that person down, it can even lead beyond even depression, almost to a form of PTSD, where a person feels traumatized by the constant erosion of you know, they're having to have that internal struggle with their value system. And the external world is dissonant with their internal ethics. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a person of ethics swimming in a toxic ocean, eventually the swimmer gets tired, and sometimes they stop swimming and sometimes they give up. So it's hard, you know. So that's why as much as we can support those young people who are really trying to stay true to their values, wherever they can get support, whether it's in their faith or their family or their peer groups or other types of activities, they can plug in and recharge. That's what we try to do with my treatment program. We try to really reinvigorate young people to kind of be able to, you know, and there's a metaphor that I use that it's the ocean is very turbulent right now. And our job is to help make young people better swimmers, because we're not going to change the ocean. Unfortunately, society is going the way that society is going. And, you know, maybe we could make some changes around the edges, but we have to teach our young people how to swim better in turbulent seas.
Mm-hmm. And it's profound that you're saying that even the good kids who are trying to do the right thing, they have a faith, they have a conscience, they have a moral ethic. They're experiencing depression, PTSD from constantly trying to do that. It makes me think of a story, Dr. Carderis. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Trending with Tim Murray here on Relevant Radio. That's Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He's the country's foremost technology addiction expert. And I think of this story. It was written some years ago by a feminist who was talking about how she'd been in a relationship with a young Catholic man. They're two young adults in their professional careers, and they're dating each other, and they're regularly engaging in sex outside of marriage. And every time they do, he's the one being, you know, Catholic and regularly practicing Catholic who's experiencing a lot of guilt. And so she said, every time the next day he talked about how he needed to, you know, make better decisions, be chaste, would talk about marriage, and he would go to confession. But then we would go through this over and over again. We'd have periods of abstinence. But eventually, after a while of dating, all of a sudden he started to struggle with, like, basically being both obsessed with intimacy and at the same time struggling with extreme Catholic guilt. And so her argument in the end is, looks like that Catholic guilt and that Catholicism didn't go so well for him in the end. And I looked at the story and thought how sad at a certain point he broke. He was trying to do the right thing. He was trying to say, hey, I want marriage. I want to wait for marriage. But just the culture we live in, he was struggling with self-control. And that really appeals to kind of the story you're sharing as well, but on the opposite side for the young men.
Yeah, and you see that a lot, those breaking points that are really heartbreaking to see. You know, I worked with a young teenager. She was valedictorian of her class, and she had one, you know, let's call it one bad summer. You know, of course, you know, it was a relationship with the bad boy that she was trying to rescue and trying to save. Mm-hmm. And once you give in to certain behaviors, once you go down a certain path, then the floodgates burst. And that's what happened with her. She, again, in her efforts to rescue this boy, instead of her saving him, he corrupted her. And once she went down the certain path, you know, it's like eating a bag of potato chips. You eat the first potato chip, then it becomes easier to rationalize and justify the next act that, you know, is, and not just sexually, but in a variety of behaviors that, you know, are not in accordance with your ethics. And by the end of the summer, this young teenager was an entirely different person, And that was a wake up call for a lot of us at that time, because she was sort of the pillar of the young community in my community at that point. And to see how rapidly she caught her family by surprise, caught her school by surprise, caught everybody that really was a cheerleader for this young woman, were shocked at how quickly, once the levee broke, she broke. And and it took a while in her particular case to kind of get her back to someone, because then you're struggling with shame and guilt, and then that keeps you away from coming back to even attempting to come back to who you were, because you can't even face your peers at that point. You can't face your family. So now you feel alienated and self-loathing, and that creates its own energy. So
let's talk a little bit about that healing, because the goal is healthy relationships, having the capacity ultimately for healthy, happy, lifelong marriages in the end. How do we get that back? Many men and women, as well as young boys and girls, are experiencing a disorientation with regard to sexuality. How do you reclaim that healthy sexual identity following the ethic that you choose to have, that self-control?
Yeah, that's that's the question of the day, isn't it? You know, to some degree, I think we also have to be forgiving of ourselves too, because, you know, I know the Japanese have a great expression, the branch that doesn't bend breaks. And we were just talking about people breaking. And so I do think, you know, I know we talk about faith a lot, and you know, the ultimate person who can forgive, and we talk about forgiving ourselves. Now, you know, I deal a lot with addiction, and it's a fine line, because this is an example. I'll use something like a relapse. We want to forgive the person who relapses. We want them to forgive themselves, but we also don't want to make it such an easy process that then the person starts, it becomes normalized. And so we make mistakes, but we shouldn't have that be our goal. So we should be forgiving while we set fairly high standards of ourselves. And I think kind of societally that's shifted. You know, I've studied the classics and philosophy and comparative religions, and there were certain lattice works, structures that gave us a sense of support and foundational stones that we can build our houses on. And a lot of that has been torn away. So I think in relationships moving forward, I think we have to try to be our best selves. We have to be honest when we have shortcomings. The last thing that you want to do is be dishonest about behavior that you've engaged in that you're uncomfortable about. And I mean this in married relationships. If something has happened, whether it's a small thing or a big thing, because we know the little lies can lead to bigger lies because it normalizes being dishonest, being fully transparent and being accepting of ourselves and our partners, if there has been a mistake, obviously we don't want to encourage the continuous mistakes that have happened. Mm-hmm. But we have to honor and value honesty, or else, because then you start creating... you start compartmentalizing little lies, and you know, people start living second, you know, double lives where, you know, they've created a fictitious narrative in their work settings, and then they have a whole different identity when they go home, or people have multiple relationships and they're lying to all of them, and mm-hmm. that's nowhere to live. And we're seeing this fractured sense of identity sort of echoed, and maybe that could be part of our transition to the trans conversation, but people's sense of identity itself is fractured right now. Right. There's an explosion of dissociative disorder.
Yes.
People with multiple personalities. There's such a sense of confusion where young people do not know who they are right now. And their messaging that they get is, it's all right to be anybody and everyone. Instead of reinforcing a strong sense of identity, we're blurring the lines of identity where, you know, everything from birthing people mm-hmm. to... pick the gender you want, and you can have multiple identities.
Yes,
and it's
right.
Insane.
Right. Insane. I want to come back on that topic because the trans identity, the trans effect, as is being referred to, is influencing kids just based on social media today. And so we're going to come back with Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He's the country's foremost technology addiction expert here on Trending. We're going to unpack this transgender effect of social media on kids, teens, and really young adults today. The number is 1-888-914-9149. If you have a question, you can also ask your question now on my Instagram at Timmerie, TimmerIe.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmerie on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
It's our weekly marriage hour here on Trending. Joining me is Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He's the foremost technology expert in the United States. And we're talking about the transgender effects of social media on kids and teens. Dr. Carderis, you work firsthand with many teenagers who have suffered from technology addiction. And one of the current trends we are seeing is this trans effect, this trans craze that people on both sides of the political spectrum, people of multifaceted religious perspectives are seeing this out of nowhere phenomena where in particular young women are suddenly claiming that they're transgender. They're starting cross-sex hormones, or cutting off their hair. They're even looking at going through with a so-called sex change, which isn't possible. Can you speak to your thoughts on what's happening and how this social media is influencing this transgender effect?
Yeah, this is so fascinating and troubling at the same time, because it's It's such a political hot potato. I mean, careers are being destroyed over this. People are being really silenced by fear of losing, you know, people in the academic world, people in the clinical world. And I guess I'm at a point in my career where I don't really care in terms of the so-called repercussions that might happen if people sort of speak the truth about this, because it's clear, there are certain things that are clear, and some of the research points this out in just our own observation. Even if we acknowledge, which I do, I fully acknowledge that there is a disorder, which is in the DSM, called gender dysphoria, that there have always been, throughout societies, throughout the last few thousand years, a very, very, very small percentage of people who identify with the gender other than the one that they were born into. That historically has always been such a microscopic subset of society that it was considered a disorder, and it was, as I said, a very small disorder. Now we're seeing such a huge explosion, especially amongst, as you mentioned, adolescent females who are identifying as trans. And you know, it was Dr. Lippman, Lisa Lippman at Brown University, who did the groundbreaking study about rapid onset gender dysphoria. And she looked at this phenomenon of young teenage girls that were all of a sudden identifying as trans. And one of the common denominators that she found was that this was happening after an extended exposure to social media. And so there's a phrase that we use called social contagion effects. And the social contagion is essentially what it says. It's something that spreads socially. And so social contagion can be smoking. If you hang out with a group of kids who smoke and you begin to smoke, smoking becomes a social contagion. So we know that things like suicide can be a social contagion, suicide clusters. When the idea behind something like a suicide cluster or a social contagion is the first person who does it sort of lowers the bar of normalcy and makes it a more normative experience. And the second person who does it lowers the bar even further, and the third person, and so forth and so forth. So eventually something goes from being, and this is what I think has happened with the trans movement. We've gone from trying, I think, well-intentioned to destigmatize some poor and fortunate people who are struggling with gender dysphoria, because it's not easy to have gender dysphoria. We've gone from destigmatizing to normalizing to idealizing. And so what's happened now, to be trans is an ideal. I work with high school kids and I work with young adults in my treatment programs. It's almost, not almost, it is aspirational to be trans. These are the cool kids now. The cool kids have this phenomenon. So in the social contagion phenomenon, so we've seen things like TikTok has spread psychiatric disorders like Tourette syndrome. TikTok influencers who have Tourette syndrome have spread that. They have 2 billion views, and there were thousands of young teenage girls that started demonstrating physical tics that mimicked these influencers. So if it can happen with Tourette syndrome, we've seen it with things like borderline personality disorder. There are borderline personality influencers that influence young people to then mimic those symptoms. And I mentioned earlier dissociative disorder. There are influencers right now on TikTok who claim to have over 100 identities. And those identities, by the way, cover the whole LGBTQI spectrum. So they're called systems, and the host body, as they're called, will have a 48-year-old lesbian female and a 12-year-old male boy and the whole range, the whole spectrum of identities, because there's so much confusion around who they really are. And we know that in the social media world, the coin of the realm, the most popular, is the people who get the most followers. And the people who get the most followers on social media are the most performative, the most over the top. So you'll have people with the most over the top psychiatric behavior, 100 personalities, which even when people had genuine multiple personality disorder, it used to be, and these were rare cases of sexually abused children who created alter identities, it used to be maybe 3, 4, or 5. We never used to have cases of 100 identities. These are new social media phenomenon. And I put the gender effect, the trans effect, as part of this. These are young people who are seeing this these influencers who have millions of or hundreds of millions of followers in some cases, and they begin to mimic the behavior. And in my treatment program, we've had a handful of young people who had identified as trans, who after 8 weeks of residential treatment with dialectical behavioral therapy and some of the different psychotherapy that we do, got better with their borderline personality disorder, which in and of itself has identity confusion as one of the symptoms. And once they became better psychologically, they said, oh, we're not trans after all. That was just sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so to say that, I don't think it's transphobic. I think it's trans-explanatory. I think we have to try to explain why there's such a huge spike. It doesn't normally happen that you see a psychiatric issue like this multiply 100-fold in 10 years. There's got to be some other explanation, because our biology hasn't changed significantly. Nothing has changed significantly except for this new ocean that we're swimming in called social media that everyone's immersed in.
Dr. Carderas, I'm so grateful for your truth and your boldness on this issue, because as you said, we're at a point in history where there's a massive cancel culture mob out there. And for you saying anything that opposes a transgender identity, they have a problem with that. And I appreciate where you say this is trans explanatory. It helps to understand why there is this sudden and rapid onset in a vast number of young girls in particular. Right. You mentioned borderline personality disorder. What you're pointing to is the fact that many people who experience transgender identity, which is gender dysphoria, as you say it, usually have something that precedes that, whether it's actually depression. I hear all the time from young people who have detransitioned after having gone through cross-sex hormones, after being encouraged by a number of people, who will say, you know, I was encouraged by people. I was told to, you know, look at into my past and look at various things that, you know, said, see, I am transgender. But then when I really stopped and looked, when I had some massive anxiety attack or was at my lowest of lows, I looked back and realized what I was really struggling with was, let's say, depression. Can you speak to some of those other disorders, from depression to eating disorders to, as you mentioned, borderline personality disorder and others that are often preceding any sort of gender dysphoria, and how these aren't being treated beforehand?
Right. They're comorbid with it. And so they may they may manifest themselves as gender dysphoria. But the problem is, and this is the Orwellian part that really bothers me, sometimes with, you know, this transgender transitioning, they've renamed it. They've renamed surgical and medical interventions, hormonal treatments, as gender-affirming healthcare, in the same way that they'll call abortion reproductive healthcare. You know, abortion is not reproductive healthcare, it's abortion. Having hormonal therapy, if somebody is going through a transitory psychiatric phase, and I'm not saying that's the case in all instances, but what we've seen is that in some instances, and many instances, and I think one of my colleagues points this out, the mental state of people who have transitioned, who've actually go and have transgender reassignment surgery, they are still in they still have the same psychological issues after the fact. Mm-hmm. They don't all of a sudden become miraculously, you know, happy is sort of an arbitrary word, but they don't become psychologically well once after they've had the reassignment surgery. And in fact, many have had buyer's remorse. And so if it is something that's transitory and we're rushing into permanent, you know, they used to say suicide was a permanent a solution to a temporary problem. I'm afraid that sometimes gender reassignment surgery could be a permanent solution to what might be a temporary phase. And again, I know that's going to be called transphobic. I write about this at length in my new book, which is coming out in September, called Digital Madness. And it's not just about this, but I do talk about this specifically throughout the book, because there's new types of, there's new ways that our young people are being unwell that we've never seen before. And these are direct byproducts of this new world, as I mentioned before, that we're swimming in. And it's just so unfortunate that clinicians and parents can't even maybe ask the question, is it possible that a percentage of gender dysphoria may not be the authentic disorder, but maybe let's call it a social media, social contagion. Mm-hmm. And if you even ask that question, you, as you mentioned, cancel culture and careers get destroyed and everything else. So I feel like we all, to be true to ourselves and to our ethics, need to reject the mob and to be able to sort of speak up our truth to, mm-hmm. not truth to power. It used to be, it's ironic that, you know, what used to be marginalized communities, you know, we've all wanted to support marginalized communities, but now it feels like the marginalized communities are now the bullies in the room and are not allowing other people to speak or to have a voice or to have an opinion or professional opinion on an issue.
It's interesting you say that, because I keep thinking they can try to cancel you, but what you are doing is so important. You are doing life-saving work, helping people in the midst of addiction come out of those addictions, heal from substance, mental health, technology addiction. So they can try to cancel you, but there is such a demand for what you're doing. It's right. not possible. It is truly not possible. And if you're not aware of Dr. Cardera's work, OmegaRecovery.org is, he's a CEO there helping treat young people struggling with these addictions. He wrote the book some years ago that is so relevant still today, called Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trans. 10 out of 10 must read. We'll include a link in the podcast notes as well as in on social media. So check out those resources for that. Follow me at Tim Marie, TimMMERIE. Dr. Cardera, it's kind of a last question on this. And I know this is opening kind of another can of worms, but I know that you have also taught neuropsychology at the doctoral level. And so you've seen a lot of the neuroscience on many of the differences between men and women. And I know today that neuroscientists are kind of, they have their backs up against a wall today, because on the level of the brain, there are so many incredible, phenomenal differences between men and women. And when they say that, they're being called neurosexist for this. Right. What role does neuroscience play in this debate, and how do we continue to present this truth?
Right. So there are neurophysiological differences between the sexes. That's been known forever. But Timur, we have to look, we're living in a society where we can't even acknowledge that there's reproductive differences between the sexes. We had a Supreme Court candidate asked to define a woman. And interestingly, which I always found this fascinating, in her response, she said, I'm not a biologist. Now, she should have said, right, if she was true to her own ideals, because if she wants to say that gender is a social construct and is fluid, she should have said, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a psychologist. But interestingly, she said, I'm not a biologist, and which would imply that there are biological differences, and we know that there are neurophysiological differences. There are certain, I won't get into the detailed part, but there are neurophysiological differences in parts of the male and the female brains, which is why there is sometimes rare cases of gender dysphoria, where you will see that the neurophysiology matches up with the other gender, that it's not the gender, that the person is genuinely trapped in the biology of the reproductive organs of the wrong gender. But that is, as we said before, extremely rare, and we have to have compassion for those rare people. But that doesn't mean that now we have to paint a broad brush and say that we're going to be teaching three-year-olds at age and appropriate stages of their development to pick a gender when they're still trying to figure who they are. You know, I'm a certain age in my life. I'm 58, and I know who I am. And because I know who I am, and because I've done the work in my life, whether it's the growth work or spiritual work, we can sort of hold our heads up high, and like you're doing, God bless you, you're speaking your truth. We need more spiritual warriors to speak the truth. And the science is on our side. You know, the sciences are on our side, but you know, in this Orwellian age that we've devolved into, up is down and down is up, and it's insane. And I refuse to play that game anymore, because, you know, I have young children. I have 15-year-old twin boys, and I don't want to see them grow up in a world that's so upside down.
It's interesting. You bring up so many important things here, and you brought up something that I think is important. You first just acknowledging the difference in neuroscience and neuropsychological differences is so profound. And there's proof here. We don't have to fight on this because we stand on solid ground, but it's misinformation, a lack of information. A simple Google search is not going to pull up the results of truth. And that's just what's sad today. But you brought up that there are cases where people legitimately are suffering from damage neuropsychologically in the genitalia, even sometimes on the level of the chromosomes. But the most honest thing with the best medical and psychological integrity is to do the best we can where, okay, there's ambiguous genitalia. What can we learn from the chromosomes? Do we know whether this person's a male or a female from the chromosomes? So therefore, can we help in perhaps then reconstructing in, you know, a situation where, you know, there's some form of deformity? We do the best we can. And these are compassionate situations, but that's not what this onset of this transgender craze is. I'm really looking forward to your forthcoming book this fall, Digital Madness. We will talk about it here. We're so grateful for what you're doing. If you'd like to follow Dr. Nicholas Carderis and his work and learn more about the Omega Recovery Center, you can find him at omegarecovery.org. And please pick up his book, Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trans. I'll be right back here on Trending with Tim Ray to take some of the most recent debates surrounding abortion, your questions, and to give you an update on the attempt to kill babies even after birth in the state of California. Major vote today. You need to hear the latest news.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to Trending. It's our weekly marriage hour, and I want to share some good news with you. Often we'll talk here on Trending about the challenge that many families, many parents go through in this battle between, you know, work and family life. And for moms, you know, being a stay-at-home mom versus a working mom, we've even talked about the challenge for many single parents who, you know, if they're no, you know, of yes, you know, maybe perhaps bad choices, but they find themselves, you know, they're striving to live a strong Catholic faith, but they're a single parent now trying to live that ideal. And a couple weeks ago, a mom wrote to me, you know, saying, well, what about single moms? And should, you know, what advice do you have? And so we'd walked through that conversation. We'll include a link in the podcast notes where we actually do discuss single moms and kind of that challenge that or single parents in general that those parents can go through. But I wanted to talk about, you know, kind of the praise report. One of the things that I shared was about how when we're in various situations, whether it's, you know, you really want to spend more time with your kids, but just financially, it's not possible for you to be home more or to leave your job and come home. Maybe you want to drop down to one income. Maybe you're a single parent and you're working so many shifts and you wish you could work less because in this case, this mom shared, she knows that it's impacting your kids. She would love to be home full time with her kids. And so I really appealed to how when we're trying to do the right thing, when we're trying to follow God's vision and plan for you know, our lives, that yes, there are sometimes seemingly roadblocks that make it impossible to do that. But with God, all things are powerful. His intercession, His intervention, His good and great gifts. He makes things possible that people would never believe were possible. And so a mom who had written to me in that situation, she's a single parent. She knows that the lack of time spent with her kids is really impacting her children. And I encourage her, pray that God's able to help you meet the needs of your children, to be able to spend more time with them, to send role models and people who are going to be a positive influence to help fill that void as you're having to fill the void of their father and take on those responsibilities that he otherwise would have been going through. And so she said, you know, this really helped. She really appreciated that. But she said something happened this week. She said there's an opening with less hours that will allow me to be more involved for my children. She said it's a really big pay cut, but she said I truly feel it's necessary. My children will grow up and forever be adults, but as kids, they are only kids once. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. I was so proud of this mom who is saying, you know what, this will be a pay cut. This will be difficult, but it will allow me to be with my kids more. And that's one thing that I think that we need to remember over and over again. You can buy your kids a lot of things, but you can't buy back time with your kids. Time that your kids so desperately need. Fight to preserve that time. You know, your kids don't need all of those things that we try so hard to buy them and give them. They're so happy and satisfied with you. I remember hearing a study done some years ago about teenagers, and they did a study of teenagers, and the question was, would you rather 20 books or would you rather, let's say, I think it was like half an hour with one of your parents? And the kids across the board chose the parent time over the $20. Teenagers, we're talking about teenagers. And the parents assumed and guessed that the kids would prefer the $20. And the parents were astounded that over and over again, these children, these teenagers were choosing that they'd rather be with the parent. And so this speaks volumes to, even in the midst of a culture where teenagers seemingly tune you out, they are listening. Your presence matters. Your parents, your presence makes a life-changing difference. In prayer and God's intervention, striving to follow His plan for our lives, truly He will move mountains. He answers prayers. And this was one mom's answer to prayers and her fighting to be with her kids, even, you know, if that means a little less in terms of money in order to spend more time with her kids. It's a trade that she is willing to make. You're listening to Trending with Timmeri here on Relevant Radio. Okay, news. Boy, do I have news. So we've been following the story in the state of California where there are a number of pro-abortion bills that are quickly passing various committees. One bill is Senate Bill 1375 in California that would allow nurses, not doctors, not trained doctors, but nurses to perform abortion without a doctor present. This has actually passed today, the Senate Appropriations Committee, and will head to the Senate, full Senate floor, for a vote next week. Unfortunately, we are seeing these radical pro-abortion laws or bills quickly pass through a very pro-abortion legislator in California. California is working to become an abortion safe haven. A travel destination. Literally, some places in California are preparing, setting up, and already advertising as abortion spas. It is despicable what we are seeing. We need California. We need to be on the ground, boots on the ground, praying, intervening in front of these abortion clinics and so-called abortion spas where they are destroying women's lives and destroying babies, literally killing them. But here's just something I can't even believe is happening. And yet it is expected in the current California legislature, Assembly Bill 2223 passed out of the California Assembly Appropriations Committee today. This bill basically gives unfettered access to abortion in California, not just all the way up to birth, but if you read the language of the bill, and I told you, I read it weeks ago, months ago, it says it refers to the legalization of perinatal death, and anyone associated with or the mother would not be held culpable for a perinatal death. What is a perinatal death? That is where a baby dies or is killed after birth. Now, perinatal death is an indefinite amount of time. Sometime that can mean up to 7 days after birth, but that can also mean longer. And this is not defined in this bill. Perinatal death, that language is indeed there. So what this would allow is that if someone were to kill a baby outside of the womb, 7 days or possibly even older, that wouldn't go prosecuted. That wouldn't go punished. No one would be held culpable, from the mother to those who aided, abetted, and participated in. So what happens if a father kills his baby 6 days after birth? Well, he will be charged for homicide. But if a woman killed her baby 6 days after birth, there would be no level of culpability. The difference, my friend, in today's society, possibly what will become law in the state of California, is that it's okay to kill a baby if that baby's wanted, but it's not okay to, sorry, it's not okay to kill a baby if it's, you know, this difference. I'm getting it all wrapped up because it's so mind-boggling. It's okay to kill a baby if it's unwanted, but if it's wanted, you can't kill a baby. Does that make sense? You can kill a baby as long as it's unwanted, whether it's inside of the womb or outside of the womb. That's how far the logic of the California legislature is going, and they very well may legalize this. We are looking face to face with the horror of abortion, the evil. It is demonic. It is child sacrifice. And we must be willing to stand, to speak, to pray, to fast. If you're in the state of California, I'm begging you, stand in front of those abortion clinics and pray. If you never sidewalk counseled before, maybe prayerfully consider doing so. If you can support your crisis pregnancy centers and help build them up to be able to answer the needs of women who are suffering from postpartum depression, don't know what to do with their kid, they're in a crisis, we need to provide the help and support in our communities to build up a culture of life in the midst of a culture of death. Stay tuned. We'll see what will happen in the state of California. We must pray and fast for a miracle. Does birth control use lead to higher rates of unplanned pregnancies? This is Timory from Trending with Timory. Friday, we're going to take some of those questions and claims that people make that simply aren't true, such as responding to the false claim that when abortion isn't accessible, there's a higher maternal mortality rate. This isn't true. We'll take those questions and more, so join me Friday at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.